start with some in Yonah the Oma. The Iowa caucuses are tonight.
Oh, really? Yeah, Iowa caucus, please.
This is big stuff.
And the Iowa caucuses helped answer a question that I always had on the Tefillah of Ashrei. Always going through Ashrei, there were certain psukim that appealed to me a lot more than others. You start off Ashrei, God, I'm just going to say how great you are every day. God is so great, right? You can't imagine how great he is. We'll always say how great he is. You go on, and it always felt to me like there's no real content in Ashrei until you get to like Tov Hashem Lakol V'Rachem Avakol Ma'asav. So God is good to everyone, and he's merciful to all of his creatures. And then you get back to the same, Yoducha Hashem Kol Ma'asecha V'Chasidach Yerevuch. Everyone's going to see how wonderful you are. V'Omel Chaschai Meiru V'Roschai Dabir. We'll see how strong you are and how glorious you are. V'Odil V'Nehadam V'Rosham V'Chvod Adar Malchus Soel. We're going to tell everyone how great you are. And it goes on that way until you get to So he supports those who are falling, and he helps people stand up even if they're bent over. You support people, you provide things to people who are in need. Then again, you have back to the Vajan Tzadikshem Chodarcham. So it always like bothered me that there were so many of these like vague generalizations happening in Ashrei. And it struck me that when you have people standing at street corners and campaigning that you should vote for this candidate or that candidate in the primary, so they're not standing at street corners and saying, like, okay, this candidate, let me tell you her or his agenda for healthcare or for taxes or immigration reform. Like, that's all, it's on the websites, it's in the news, it's in the mailings and everything else. But when people are standing at the street corners and like it's down to crunch time and they want you to vote for a particular candidate, they're just saying, yeah, go him, go her, go this one, go that one. It's all about the harab. Yeah, it is very fluffy. And to a certain extent, I think, that's what's happening with Ashrei, as well, is that we want everyone to, go God. Everyone should buy into that idea. And so that's part of what Ashrei is. Now, there's a pragmatic necessity for this, and that is that we need to act in a way that will increase Kavod Shamayim. And so sometimes Kavod Shamayim is increased by subtle, nuanced, very precise argumentation. And sometimes Kavod Shamayim is increased by saying, go God, rah, rah, rah. And each one has its own time that it's supposed to be applied. This actually connects very nicely to what the packet is about. The Ramban has a line. If I had chalk or marker, I'd write it on the board.
Okay, not in the other room.
I think there was at least one with both options.
Yeah, there used to be one in this drawer, but I think that when I brought my children to visit Yeshiva, so somebody gave it to them, and then who knows what happened to them. This line, if you want to look at it in the packet, it's on page 12. page 12, the second wide line of the Ramban towards the end, we have it on board also, though it's much more legible in the packet. Zohi kat ha-tzedukim sheshmam b'mizrach karayim. This is referring to or accurately describes the group of the tzedukim, the Sadducees, who in the East are called the Karaites.
The Karaites can be a tzedukim?
Oh, so that is the historical question. We know that the tzedukim date back to the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, and the Karaites date back to the time of the Amoraim. So there were centuries in between the tzedukim and the Karaites. So why is the Ramban identifying the tzedukim with the Karaites? What is it? What's the common denominator that causes that? It's not just the Ramban, by the way, but it's pretty much all of the Rishonim who lived in that time, who seem to identify the Karaites as being basically just the tzedukim.
They both didn't believe in Torah Shel Peh.
They both did not believe in Torah Shel Peh.
And the power of the Rabbanim.
Hmm?
And the power of the Rabbanim.
And the power of the Rabbanim, right. So the Ramban brings this in terms of his discussion about pragmatically speaking. I mean, let's say that you disagree with the conclusion of the Chachamim. So the Gedolei Hadar will say this, and you believe that. So the Ramban makes, among other arguments, a very pragmatic argument. He says, even if you disagree, and you believe that the community's policy should be something other than it is, it's important to still show unity and support, you know, the party platform, so to speak. And the reason for that, says Ramban, is because if the goal is to increase Kvod Shamayim, if the goal is that God's values should be spread and implemented in the world, then you have to make a calculation. It could be that the policy that the community is pursuing is not as effective as the policy that you would like them to pursue. But if you pursue your own policy separate from the rest of the community, so then the net result will be less Kvod Shamayim. If you add your resources, your energy, your excitement, your rah-rah-rah, right, to the party, and don't split it, then ultimately you'll accomplish more for Kvod Shamayim. And again, you can use contemporary politics as a muscle. Right? What will happen if one of the major parties splits, right? With half the party saying we just can't vote for this candidate, so we're going to vote for that one, and this candidate go independent. So is that party going to win the election or lose the election?
They're both going to lose.
Well, right. I mean, both of the splinter parties are going to lose. It's only if they combine all together that they have a chance of winning. And the same thing, the Ramban is saying, that's exactly what we lost when the Tzedukim splintered off of mainstream Judaism. And that's exactly what we lost when the Karaites splintered off of mainstream Judaism. In both cases, what they did was they split the party. And since then, we've never really been able to function at full strength the way that we were when there was unity within Klal Yisrael. Now, obviously, the Tzedukim were wrong, and the Karaim were wrong. The Ramban is not spotlighting that right now. He's not focusing, he's not highlighting that. He's highlighting, even if they were right, even if they were right, it was wrong of them to do what they did, right? Because by splintering the community, they ended up sacrificing more than they would have gained. So that's very critical, the pragmatic argument for unity. And the Ramban also has a more idealistic argument for unity, at least for unity when it's unity in following the party line as determined by the Sanhedrin Agad. And that is in the Ramban, in his commentary on the Torah, all the way at the end, where he makes some nice puns. For those of you who are familiar, say your daily Tehillim, catch the nice puns that the Ramban makes. It's on page 6. Last paragraph, second line in the middle. Sorry, second line, second word. Is Ki Ruach Hashem al Mishtarsei Mikdasho, that the Spirit of God rests on Mishtarsei Mikdasho. for the Mishra Seem Bishop.
The angels. It's referring to the angels.
Ruach Hashem al Mishrasi. What about the Mikdash?
The
Kohanim. Kohanim.
Mishmaris.
Misharis. Like a Kli Sharis. Mishiris. Mishim Hashem Elokav. Malachi Sharis. That's what you're thinking of, right?
What does Sharis mean?
It's like officers.
Serve.
Like Sra'ra would be to be an officer. Sharis. I mean, they're not mutually exclusive. You can talk about, you know, the royal butler, right, who has a lot more access and influence, you know, at court than probably many other people who are less subservient in that sense. But Sharsi Mikdasho here, I think, is a reference to the Kohanim. The Kohanim are described in many places in Torah Shabbat as being the Misharsim. And in a broader sense, the Ramban seems to be referring to the Sanhedrin, the Dayanim of the Sanhedrin Agadol, who probably, all things being equal, should be drawn from the ranks of the Kohanim rather than the ranks of the Israelim. And then he goes on, he says, Lo Ya'azov et Chasidav, that God will not abandon his Chasidim, Le'olam Nishmaru min ha'taus u'min ha'michshol. They'll always, they have permanent protection against error and against stumbling. So here, the Ramban seems to be making a very different argument in favor of showing unity, uniting behind the party line. And that is that the people who are making the policy are much more qualified to make policy than we are. And therefore, we should always just keep in mind the limitations at which, the limitations on our experience, the limitations on our knowledge, that make us not as qualified to make policy, in contrast with the lack of limitations that applies to those Mishrasei HaMikdash, the Chasidim, who are always have the Siyata Dishmaya. So that brings us to the central question, the central question that unifies all the sources in this packet. So what exactly is it? What's the main question? That if there's one thing that binds together all the sources, one question, one topic heading, what would that be?
What's the limit to which we have to listen to authority?
What's the limit to which we have to listen to authority? I tend to think very graphically. So the question I ask myself is like this. Let's say that I have a dispute with the Sanhedrin Agadol. You have a dispute, the Sanhedrin Agadol, and you're fighting it out with them or whatever it is, and you're convinced that they're just wrong, dead wrong. And it seems intellectually dishonest for you to abandon your position, which they have failed to convince you is wrong, but you still believe it's right. It's intellectually dishonest, right? Isn't it? So at what point do we say that intellectual honesty wins out? And at what point do we say that either the pragmatic argument for unity wins out, or the idealistic argument for unity wins out? You know, maybe we should doubt our certainty. And even if we can't doubt or don't doubt our certainty, but maybe we should just toe the party line for the sake of unity and increasing Kavod Shemayim. So how does one balance those conflicting values? Yes.
Well, I feel like a lot of times when everyone's kind of, like you said, everyone's agreeing with each other for the sake of unity, a lot of times they can be agreeing to the wrong thing. They can be all making a big mistake because they're kind of like not thinking about it so critically because they just kind of want to agree with everybody. Like, one person maybe makes a mistake, everyone kind of just agrees with them. So that's one of the problems with everyone just agreeing blindly and following one party just for the sake of peace. They can make a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It happened a lot, like, in history, while you're on the politics and such. Like, the Cuban Missile Crisis. The invasion.
The Bay of Pigs invasion.
So that was kind of like the idea behind that was it Kennedy? So Kennedy, he had like his whole chamber and cabinet, And they were kind of all agreeing to this thing, no one really thinking so critically about, like, wait a second, we're invading this whole thing, place full of guerrilla warfare with our people who have known nothing of the place. And then they realized that it was a huge mistake, because they were kind of all agreeing for the sake of unity.
So how do you know? How do you make that assessment?
How do you make that assessment?
Meaning, let's say again, you're the individual who disagrees with everybody else.
Yeah.
And you think that they're all just, you know, following the leader. And not only do you know that you're right, but you also know that why it is that they're being misled into thinking what they're thinking.
So you don't have to, the person shouldn't be like arguing with them and yelling at them, but he should at least spark a discussion so they can actually at least talk about it instead of just thinking in one way. Even if he'll eventually agree to them because he sees maybe their way is right after.
So let me answer. Of the five answers, right, to this question about where to draw the line, which one does what you're saying most closely resemble?
What were the five?
Okay, let's go through the five. Mm-hmm. Anyone? Start out.
Sorry, I have to really spread
out. He's saying, like, I think it was Rambam who said that, maybe Zimbabwe, that you have to go and talk it out.
Oh, the Rambam. I think that,
yeah.
Rambam says that until you have mentioned all of your arguments to the Sanhedrin, you are obligated to go by intellectual honesty.
Yeah.
Right? To do what you think is right. Because I guess you're convinced that once they've heard all of your arguments, they're going to come to agree with you. So you're not going to listen to them, right, based on where they're holding now. You're listening to, you know, to them based on where you expect them to be holding after. So then there's no penalty, there's no isser,
yes,
in practicing your own. Right? So you could say, look, you guys, you know, I feel like we're just having a repeat of the Bay of Pigs. And let's think for a second. Are we simply blindly following the leader, right? Or is everyone here really expressing his true opinion? Right? Let's say that they say, okay, we think about it, and we think that we're all expressing our true opinion. So
then you wouldn't be a coordinator, because at that point we're bound, because everyone expressed their opinion, they discussed and they realized that their decision was correct or not correct. And they found the right one by intellectual honesty, and everyone expressing their opinion and considering everything.
Right. I have to respect the fact that he now was aware of my claim. He's aware that I thought that he was being a little bit misled or not thinking properly. And he thought about it, and he concluded that he is thinking properly and is not being misled. And he's a very, you know, person worthy of respect as well. And so I have to respect the fact that he's an individual who's qualified to make that decision for himself.
Yeah.
And so if I'm outvoted, even after I voice all of my concerns, so then I have to be mevatel my das and go together with the party line. Again, both for the pragmatic reason, because we can accomplish more if we're unified than we can if we're splintered, and for the idealistic reason, because, you know, when you got these, you know, Misharsei HaMikdash and the Hasidim, and God gives him a certain measure of Siyata Deshmaya. Now, keep in mind, in my scenario, I'm also one of the Misharsei HaMikdash, and also one of the, I'm a member of the Sanhedrin of God myself, right, in this scenario. Right? But at the same time, right, it's got to be that they got more Siyata Deshmaya than I do, because they're the majority, I'm the minority. It could be, for instance, it could be 36 to 35, and we'll still pass them that way. Well, the 35, we have to assume that there's more Siyata Deshmaya to the 36 than to the 35. So that's the Ramban's answer. What are some of the other answers?
That it's only in a situation of understanding. I mean, if there's facts, the Ramban probably agrees with that.
No,
meaning if you think their mistake is a mistake based on an understanding that's so clear to you, that's different than if you think they're making a mistake based on a misled fact.
Okay, so that's a little bit different than the Ramban. That's the answer that was suggested by all the Sifreis.
Oh, no, the explaining the Sifreis.
Shabba, perhaps,
yeah.
Shlomo Kluger,
yeah,
also. So they say there's a difference between when you're absolutely certain and when there's room for doubt. Meaning, let's say that you're a member of the Sanhedrin and you have a disagreement with the other 70 sages of the Sanhedrin. And the protocol is, you ask yourself, am I 100% certain about my opinion? Or am I only 99% certain about my opinion? That's a very difficult question to answer. How do I know whether I'm 100% certain, 99% certain? Some personalities, people are, you know, like they call them Ish Lehava personalities, like a burning fire, like I'm right, I'm just going to carry this torch forwards. And then you have the people who are, by nature or by training, a little bit more inclined to uncertainty. And the different personalities, and even persons are a little uncertain. Sometimes they can be 100% certain of something. Yes?
Shouldn't you make someone know, like, if, let's say there's a fight between two people about whether it's this person's possession or that person's possession, you have to swear to God that it's yours, you're telling the truth. So when they do that in that case, maybe you're not going to swear to God unless you're 100% certain that you're right. So shouldn't you apply from that case to this case?
Still, let's say that the Chacham who has his opinion should swear 100%. So it's interesting. There's a Gemara in Masechta Shavuos that actually talks about this happening one time. There were two Talmidim and they were reviewing their Rebbe's Shir. And one of them said, I swear to God that this is what Rebbe said in Shir. The other one said, I swear to God that that's what Rebbe said in Shir. And they both said, oh my goodness, one of us just made a false oath. So they went and they said, like, what should we do? Like, one of us just made a shvuas sheker. What should we do? And the answer that they got was, neither of them made a shvuas sheker.
They believe they were right.
Because it's what's called a shvuas ones, basically. Like, when I believe 100% that it's true, that's what I'm swearing that I believe with certainty that it's true, but not that it actually is true. So the oath definitely would be a way for us to measure. If I'd be willing to swear to it, then I probably believe with 100% certainty that it's true.
It measures honesty, not necessarily fact.
It measures more integrity, right? Then, that's what it seems like. So that would be a good way to measure, except that it's always hard to know unless I actually make the oath. Just to ask myself, would I be willing to do it? Well, you need to actually do it, because it's always harder to hypothesize about what I would do. So, I'd be willing to, but like when I actually start talking, when I go through with it. But then that would be a good way to measure it, I think. So the Be'er Sheva says, if I'm absolutely certain, then I have to follow myself, even against the Sanhedrin. If there's uncertainty, a little bit of uncertainty, so then I should follow the Sanhedrin. Now let me ask you something. There was a second answer, which I wasn't 100% sure whether it's the same answer or whether it's a different answer. And that was the answer that was given all the way at the end of the packet in Rav Shlomo Kluger. Rav Shlomo Kluger says, if I have a tradition from my rabbis that this is the halacha, so then I should follow it even against the Sanhedrin. But if it's not a tradition from my rabbis, it's just my reading of the psukim or my synthesis of all of the information that I've received, but I never heard explicitly that this is what I'm supposed to do, so then I should defer to the Sanhedrin. So I was wondering, is that really the same thing? Is it like, if I got something from my rabbis, and I know for sure that it's right? If I just figured it out on my own, so then maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, because I can never trust myself as much as I can trust my rabbi. Right? Or is it trying to say something else that maybe... I'm not even sure what else it would be saying. Is there another reason why there would be a difference between halacha that I heard from my rabbi and halacha that I figured out on my own?
It could just be that the concept of relying on somebody else as opposed to relying on your own. You heard it from the rabbi, presumably. If a rabbi told you something, it wasn't just what he was thinking, it's what the rabbi got from something and learned and understood and told you, which is more reliable on the way I feel right now.
So it's kind of like certainty, meaning that I know that when I figure things out on my own, I make errors more often than when I heard things from my rabbi. And so therefore, I have the right to rely on my rabbi more than I would rely on myself, because statistically speaking, I'm less likely to make an error.
Yeah.
Right, so I was wondering, it just occurred to me right now, maybe you could think along different lines. I was reading... There was a book about a Balas Tshuva who used to be like a student of these Indian gurus. And she was writing how one of the big tenets of this Indian
Hinduism,
I'm not even sure which one it was, that she practiced was being mevatel yourself. Right? To always ask somebody else for advice, ask somebody else to make the decision, you know, that I think they held that it should be a guru, you know, who's attuned to the, you know, the music of the spheres or whatever it might be. Now that's the cue for the piano playing now.
Oh, that's way.
So she was writing that it happens to be that whether or not these people are attuned to whatever they're attuned to, usually people who follow this creed will arrive at a much more well thought out course of action than people who just rely on themselves. Because we're always somewhat subjective, right? We're, you know, when we have to make a decision and our interests are at stake, so we're a little bit biased to make the decision in a manner that'll lead to the greatest comfort for us, or the greatest pleasure for us, or the greatest advantage for us. And by putting the decision in somebody else's court, we're allowing a measure of objectivity to make its way into the decision-making process, which will usually end up resulting in a more balanced and ultimately a long-term, more advantageous course of action. And so I was wondering, maybe that could be what Shlomo Kluger meant. Not that when I hear from my Rebbe that it's more likely to be true, but perhaps, look, the Torah tells me to rely on somebody other than myself. So if it's me versus the Sanhedrin, I'll listen to the Sanhedrin. But if I'm anyhow relying on somebody other than myself, meaning my Rebbe, so then I've minimized the bias, I've minimized the subjectivity, and it doesn't make such a big difference whether the other that I'm relying on is a Sanhedrin, or whether the other that I'm relying on is my Rebbe, as long as it's not relying on myself. I like your answer better. I think it's much more likely that you hear from your Rebbe, so you know that it's true. If you made it up yourself, you can never know 100%. Know that that it's true, but I think that the two of them are very similar.
Yeah, they're very similar.
In the Be'er Sheva, who says 100% sure that it's true, if you're 100% sure that it's true, so then do your own thing. And if you're 99% sure, so then follow the Sanhedrin. Shlomo Kluger, if you heard it from your Rebbe, you're probably much more certain that it's true, so do your own thing. If you just made it up yourself, you're probably a little bit less certain, so follow the Sanhedrin. Right, that may also be the other answer to his question. How do I know that I'm 100% sure? How do I know? Make a shvua. Thought experiment. Would I be willing to make a shvua about it? Maybe the answer is, I heard it from my Rebbe, I can know that I'm 100% sure. So that's answer number three. We have the Ramban. Yes?
Now, I was just going to say, like, what you were saying about kind of being unbiased, I think it would be a good answer for why we need the whole system as a whole, not necessarily just in each individual like situation, what you think. Like, I think in the packet that we learned today, the Gur Arya gives like a explanation for like just not having a lot of machlokas between Klal Yisrael. That's how we have this whole system set up. I think what you were saying is a great answer for just why we have a whole system as a whole. That way, for each halachic decision, it can be approached in an unbiased manner, and we could get the best outcome. Not necessarily if we had everyone making up their own decisions, like you said, everyone would just be doing whatever, you know, even if it's subconsciously, they'll be doing what they think is best for themselves.
People have a Sanhedrin nowadays? There's so many different types of Jews.
Well, no.
I have a story about that. I don't know whether I should tell it now.
Let's hear it.
I'm not sure whether I should tell it now. The answer is that theoretically, the Sanhedrin could be reconstituted. Practically,
no one ever listens to them.
Oh no, there's a way to do it. Like I sometimes, you know, when I'm trying to fall asleep and I need a good thought experiment to do, so I try to figure out, you know, what, you know, the minimum that it would take in order to practically get a Sanhedrin reconstituted in Klal Yisrael. In some ways the minimum is very small, in other ways it's very large. It's definitely not something that we can do like right now. You get a team of, you know, 10 people and they can work for 50 years or so, I think you can get it done.
10 people.
I just feel like any substitution that was attempted and even finalized wouldn't be a good idea today because everybody's on so different, so many different planes. No matter what substitution you would make, there would be people that are guaranteed to not listen.
Yeah, good.
So better not have a
Sanhedrin centralized
instead of reinstituting a Sanhedrin that you know isn't going to be listened to, and then you're subjecting people to much.
Yes, I'm saying because there's so many different types. There are so many different groups of Jews nowadays. There's not going to be like one Sanhedrin to satisfy everybody.
But the goal of the Sanhedrin is not to satisfy everyone. The goal of the Sanhedrin is to increase Kvod Shamayim. So all that we would need to do, right, theoretically, in order for it to be wise in terms of public policy to be constituted the Sanhedrin, is to create a body which, by unifying enough elements of Klal Yisrael, will lead to the unified, you know, co-act of all those elements will have a greater positive impact than whatever the fallout and the attrition is from those elements that are marginalized.
Like people from every sin, every group, every sort of minority of Judaism? Like,
that's not so hard. Like, I mean, just imagine this question. Like, let's say that they made a Sanhedrin, right? And they didn't put Rabbi Shach on the Sanhedrin. Let's say that they did that.
So now we would be
faced with a choice, right? We could either, like, say, okay, we ratify the Sanhedrin, we'll follow all of their conclusions, and you know, because, like, they do represent, let's say, 85% of Klal Yisrael, right? Or we could say, no, we're going to keep on following Rabbi Shachter. Rabbi Shachter would also have to make the choice that he's not going to follow the Sanhedrin, which I'm not sure he would make, right? And we're going to follow him, and we're going to do our own thing. And now, again, what the probabilities would be, so first of all, how big of a loss would that be? If it unified 85% of Klal Yisrael just because we were marginalized, you know, does that...
But then people who didn't listen to them, wouldn't they be getting a bigger era by not losing the Sanhedrin?
Yeah.
As opposed to now, they're not getting a bigger.
There's definitely going to be a cost, and there's no way that it'll be reconstituted without a cost. The question, again, is to perform the cost-benefit analysis. Perhaps whatever we gain, and it's not just in terms of absolute gains versus absolute losses, it's also probabilities, because, again... What's the likelihood that Rabbi Shachter is going to choose to defy, right?
I was going to say, in your situation, Rabbi Shachter would be a Zaken Mamre, which would never happen because it's not quite his personality.
So that's awesome. Meaning, if you get enough of Klal Yisrael together, so then you would be able to reconstitute it in a way which, at least according to the analysis of whoever put it together, would lead to a greater increase of Kvod Shamayim. Even if there's a risk that some elements, will be marginalized, and a definite, you know, certainty that other elements will be marginalized, it could again. But that's a different question. I mean, there's one question which is public policy, right? How advisable is it? Which is not a question of satisfying everyone, but a question of, you know, weighing the advantages of unity against the disadvantages of marginalizing certain groups in order to achieve that unity, mm-hmm. right? Probably among other things, and that's the public policy question. And then, you know, if it's advisable, and again, I'm not saying that it for sure is advisable, but I think that depending on how it's constituted, it can be either more advisable or less advisable. And then how it would actually, you know, come about is a separate question. So we have the Be'er Sheva, who says, if you're certain, right, absolutely sure, right, then you don't follow the Sanhedrin. And the Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, who says, if you have from your Rebbe, Rabbi Soloveitchik said it. Rabbi Soloveitchik said it. I don't have to listen to the Sanhedrin. I can listen to Rabbi Soloveitchik. Right? And so those, that's answers 2 and 3. So what are the other? There's two more answers in addition to that. There was the Taz, the Divrei David.
You have to listen to that one.
Rabbi Elchanan says sort of like that. So maybe we'll do the Rebbe Elchanan because you mentioned it. So Rebbe Elchanan did two things, right? Because there were two different parts of Rebbe Elchanan in Kovitz Shiurim that Rabbi Simon had highlighted in the packet. One part was his explanation of the Ramban, and the second part was his own personal resolution of the contradiction. So Rebbe Elchanan's personal resolution of the contradiction, again, say again what you said.
That you have to listen no matter what, regardless.
You have to listen no matter what. Is that what he said?
Not quite. He was more conditioned.
No, it's almost what he said. There's one instance when you don't have to listen. It's on page 18. The paragraph is number Yud Gimel. Let me see if you find the exact quote that I want.
On page 18, I'll say Yud Gimel.
Second column, last paragraph.
I'm on 18. What?
The bracket from yesterday. From the Chabez.
There it is. I have here, it's the... It's the third line. Third line, third word. He says, the drasha de sifrei. The drasha de sifrei, which is, quote, afilu yomru lecha al smol shum yamin, on end quote, that's ka'i al akiras davar min haTorah. If they uproot something from the Torah, so then you have to listen to them, even if it's against the Torah. If they're uprooting something from the Torah, you have to listen. U'braisa di Yerushalmi, ka'i al peyusheyen, v'divrei haTorah atzma. You don't listen to them when it's a matter of interpreting the Torah. So when it's uprooting the Torah, you have to listen to them, even if you feel that they're wrong. When it's interpreting the Torah, so then you don't listen to them unless you're convinced that they're right. So what's the difference between uprooting the Torah and interpreting the Torah? Uprooting the Torah, he says, it's like a gzeira. Midyaraisa, you blow shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls in on Shabbos. Midyarabanan, we don't. Midyaraisa, we put tzitzis on certain types of linen garments. Midyarabanan, perhaps we don't. Nowadays, it's a big question. So, when the Chachamim say, we understand that this is midyaraisa permissible or forbidden, but we're telling you to do it anyhow. We're making a horas shah. We're making a gzeira drabanan. So then you have to listen. But if they say, look, we're not making a gzeira, we're not making a horas shah, we're not like telling you to do this, like, you know, amputating a limb, the rabbi, it's a metaphor. Horas shah says like amputating a limb. Sometimes you amputate a limb in order to save the patient. He says the Sanhedrin has the koach. They have the power to amputate one of the 613 mitzvahs temporarily in order to save Klal Yisrael. That's the Horasha. It's one of the special powers that are vested in the Sanhedrin. The Meshech Chachma's beautiful essay where he talks about the ramifications of that power not being applicable nowadays anymore. There's nobody that's capable of marshaling and utilizing that power. He talks about, he says that it's not necessarily a good thing for us, but that's what we have to live with anyhow. So when they use that power, they say, we know we're going against the Torah, but we're doing it with this power that's vested in us. So then you got to listen to them. You may disagree with the policy, but you can't deny that they have that power. But when they say, no, we're not using our power to go against the Torah, we're simply interpreting the Torah. This is what the Torah means. And you believe that's not what the Torah means. So then you don't listen to them. That's what Rav Chana seems to say. So no, now, I thought that Rav Chana was saying like you. But that's not what he's saying at all. Rav Chana was being very, very expansive. He's saying that any time that you have a dispute about what the Torah means, and you believe that they're mistaken, so then you can't listen to them. So it sounds like he's saying that. So that's Rav Chana's answer.
So what's his case when you don't have to listen?
His case when you don't have to listen is that Chachamim come along and they say, it says, Lo sevashel didi b'chalim imo, parshas HaShavua. Don't cook milk and meat. And they say, we have a tradition that the Torah means that it's asur midiraisa to cook chicken with milk, to have milchik chicken soup. And you say, no, my tradition is that it's only a milchik beef soup, but a milchik chicken soup is okay midiraisa. So if they came along and said, look, we acknowledge that a milchik chicken soup is okay midiraisa, but we're saying that it's asur midrabanan, which it is. So then you'd have to listen to that. They're saying, no, we're not saying it's asur midrabanan. There's no rabbinic legislation against milchik chicken soup. It's biblical. You say, that's not biblical. It's my rabbi said that basar of b'chalav is mutar midiraisa, right? Or I interpreted the psukim to indicate with absolute certainty that basar of b'chalav is mutar midiraisa. So then, Rebbe Chana seems to be saying, you don't have to listen. You listen to them when they use the power that you agree is vested in them to make rabbinic legislation. So then you have to listen, because they have the power to make rabbinic legislation. Right? It's like, you always like the muscle of the Constitution, right? So if Congress passes a law, right, where they say, okay, you know, this is allowed, or this is forbidden, this is obligatory, this is not. So then we have to listen, because the Constitution says that Congress has the power to pass laws. But if Congress says, this is what the Constitution means, that the Constitution says that you have the right to carry arms, and therefore it means this and that. So you don't have to, that's not the power vested in the Congress. Their power is to make laws. So the same thing the Ramban is saying. Even though the power is vested in the Sanhedrin HaGadol, both to make laws and to interpret laws, right, but when you also have the power to interpret laws, you only have to defer to them if they're using their power to make laws. That's fine.
So meaning it's, you do, it is kind of like what I said in that, you have to listen to anything what they say no matter what, given they do it in the correct way. Given that they say it.
Well, you're going to think it's not the correct way.
No, 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 meaning given, no matter what, you have to listen, even if you disagree and you think it's totally wrong, as long as they say what they're saying and exactly what they're wanting to do in the correct formula of their power. As long as they go within the rules, even if you disagree.
Right, but isn't that what everyone is saying? Meaning everyone is saying that there are some times that we say, even if they tell you, oh, you mean shu small and not small shu yimin, that you listen to them. And there are some times when we say, only if they tell you, you mean shu yimin and small shu small, that you listen. And the question is what the threshold between them is. To say, no, now that I'm thinking about it, right, to say that you always have to listen to them is basically denying the Yerushalmi. And it's denying the Gemara and Horios.
Say that you don't hold the
That's definitely possible. You get into the situation. Let's say, for instance, let's say that you hold like the Be'er Sheva. You hold like the Be'er Sheva, who says, when you're absolutely sure, you follow your own opinion. Let's say that the Sanhedrin holds like the Ramban. So now we'll just play it out. You hold like the Be'er Sheva. And they hold that the Be'er Sheva is wrong. So what's going to happen? What are you going to do?
Be'er Sheva, you're going to do your own thing.
You're going to do your own thing. And then what are they going to do in response to you doing your own thing?
They're going to say, you're doing something else, sir.
They'll right.
Yeah.
Because according to them, you're fucking mad. According to yourself, right, it's yimin shu yimin. Small shu small if it's not that. Right? So that's always... difficult circumstance to deal with. But
we're at the point where they're going to go through with killing you, that means we're at a point where you're not going to disagree.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to disagree enough to get killed.
No, meaning if we're at a point where we're going through with Mitas Vizdin, that probably also means that we're at a point where we all hold the same way.
Well, they can impose their will on you, right?
Right, that's true.
They control the police force.
That's true.
You can say you don't believe in them, but they say, too bad, it's going to happen.
Right. They attribute this ha'ara to Rabbi Weider, that they say that people won't become Zakin Mamre's because it's not Yehard Valyavar. Right? It's not Yehard Valyavar to eat your milk and chicken soup. Right? It's better to eat the milk and chicken soup than give up your life. And so if you know that it's going to cause them to execute you, then even if you all like the Be'er Sheva, it's not Yehard Valyavar.
And once the principles are that strong. Mm-hmm. No one's principled that strong.
All you need is one person from the whole population, or one person from all the qualified poskim.
It doesn't say in Zakim Mamre that it never happened. Meaning in most of these type cases it says, but it never happened.
That's just been
started. Doesn't say that. No, and by
Yuridafas
it says it.
Yeah. Oh, Yuridafas.
What else? There's three. And then there's always the one guy that says, but I still
by Saminga, the Catholic gets its
harassed. Yeah.
So
Shem, isn't that Yeridathas?
Shem.
Sorry, not Shem, Sodom.
Sodom. Because the Torah says, Kimapichas,
don't know. It's not Yeridathas.
Yeridathas is a city where the majority of the citizens serve Avodah Zarah. So you have to go to war and just chop off their heads and then burn all their possessions.
Is it basically Hashem doing that? Was Sodom basically him doing that?
Didn't chop off their heads, it just burnt them all.
Before the Torah, not real.
I mean, it's not a halachic.
What's the fifth answer? The task is the fifth answer. He said, Taz and Dibri Dagon made a very interesting difference. He said, when your argument with the Sanhedrin is going to be clear to everyone, right, it's going to be broadcasted on the front pages of the Jewish week. So then, by doing your thing, or passing your thing, that makes a person into a Yizakimah. But when it will remain a private matter between you and the two witnesses who saw you, so then you can rely on yourself. Now, tell me, do you think that this Taz is consistent or inconsistent with the spirit of the laws of Zaki Mamre? I consider, remember, that we saw the Ramban is that there needs to be unity, there needs to be unity, and the Gemara that you made reference to earlier, Shalo Yirbu Machlokos Bistral, that people shouldn't see that there is, you know, Torah, it's as if there's more than one Torah. So, is there a difference between a public disobedience of the Sanhedrin and a private disobedience?
Probably, yeah.
Right, because if the disobedience is private and hush-hush affair, then the impact on the broader community will be minimal. So why doesn't everyone just jump on bandwagon after the Taz and say, okay, so like that's the answer?
Because if you say that you can't do it, then you're doing it. You can't.
That's in private, just, you know, just between four.
That's working on the assumption that if it doesn't affect the community, then it all goes to naught. But you can't necessarily say. You can't say what the reasoning is.
Meaning, everything has the potential to have a ripple effect.
Right.
I can do it now, and it will only be in the headlines 2 weeks from now.
What's the term in Hebrew there? Just because the reasoning falls, the halacha doesn't.
A batal hatam, batal hakana.
Yeah.
So we have five answers, right? Just the kitzer, right? The Ramban, which is the most authoritative, which is do your own thing until you've, you know, fought it out with them. But once they've heard everything you have to say, even if they disagree with you, you have to follow them. There was the Be'er Sheva. You're absolutely certain to do your own thing. If you're not so sure, then follow them. The corollary of that, which Shlomo Kluger, you heard it from your Rebbe, so do your own thing. But if you just made it up by yourself, better to follow the Sanhedrin. And there was Rebbe Elchanan, who says if they're making a takana d'rabbanon, and zera d'rabbanon, then you have to follow them, even if you think that it's misguided and wrong, because you acknowledge they've got the power to make rabbinic legislation. And finally, the Taz, who said that if it's in public, then you got to just back down and follow them. But if it's in private, you know, you and the two edim, so then, you know, do your own thing and trust that it won't go beyond that circle of three. So the five basic answers. There were two other answers which I sort of found hinted at in the different three shonim, but they're not explicit, so I don't know how much they count.
In the packet,
they were sort of like hinted at. The Ramban, I have to say, the Ramban, all the shonim that I've read, has the richest and most suggestive language. And sometimes, like, he'll use a word which just evokes a certain idea, and you have to ask this, like, why did he use that word? And I'm never sure. Like, did he use that word because he wanted to inspire me to think what I was thinking, right? Or did he use that word because he was just such a poetic, you know, writer, and just happens to be that it inspired me to think what I was thinking, which is why I'm always a little bit hesitant, you know, to rely practically on those type of inferences. But the fact is that it's a very traditional, you know, thing to rely on those type of inferences, especially if they're consistent with other facts that one is aware of, if it's consistent, you know, with the text. And so there's two other things. I'll just mention one of them, the one which I think is more important. And that is that there's a dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban about whether a person can become a Zakin Mamre for disagreeing with the Sanhedrin about Jewish history. What do I mean? I don't mean like Jewish history about, like, you know, who was the Nasi in the year 972. When I say Jewish history, I mean the history of Jewish legislation. Meaning, there are laws on the books, and sometimes all that we have is fragments of those laws, little pieces. We don't have the original formulation, the original phraseology of the Takana. We have like a report of what went on and of what was enacted into the law. And so that leads sometimes to disputes about the scope, the parameter, the purpose of various pieces of rabbinic legislation. Was it broad? Was it narrow? Was it for this reason? Was it for that reason? Was it applicable to this situation? Or was it not applicable to this situation? So let's say, we're not talking now again, before I gave my example of my melted chicken soup, which is that you're on the Sanhedrin, and you're on the Sanhedrin, and you're debating whether or not milchik chicken soup should be asr. Now let's imagine something. Let's imagine that there's a law on the books, or maybe there's a law on the books, that milchik chicken soup should be asr. And we're 500 years later, and we're having a dispute about asr and mutter. I say the milchik chicken soup is mutter. You guys say the milchik chicken soup is asr. Maybe the opposite. You guys say the milchik chicken soup is asr, and I say it's a mitzvah to eat milchik chicken soup on Shabbos. So what should I do? You guys are the Sanhedrin. I'm just a puny little individual. So should I eat my milchik chicken soup on Shavuos? Or should I not eat it because you guys are the Sanhedrin?
So it's different than just saying it's allowed, you're saying it's actual mitzvah to do it.
Yeah, it's getting into something, I think, which is also coming up in the next packet. But
spoilers.
Right, but yeah, because if I say I'm allowed to and you guys say I'm not allowed to, so it's not going to hurt me to just not do it. And so I'd rather play it safe. But if I think it's a mitzvah, you guys think that it's aser, so then there's no playing it safe. It's a catch-22. Either I'm neglecting the mitzvah the way I think it is, or I'm doing an aver the way that you think it is. So that's why I prefer to envision it that way. So what am I supposed to do? Should I follow my own conviction that it's a mitzvah to eat the milk and chicken soup? Or should I follow you guys' conviction that it's aser? Who says that?
The
Rambam. Because the Rambam says that Lo Sasur applies to Derabanans, and then I can become a Zakin Mamri then, because what's a Zakin Mamri other than a scholar of stature who violates Lo Sasur, right? So I can become a Zakin Mamri even for disagreeing with you about a Derabanan. The Ramban, thinking back to all the way to the beginning of last semester, but it's really the same Ramban, right? Who says that Lo Sasur does not apply to Drabanans, you need some other source for Drabanans. So he says that a person cannot become a Zakin Mamre for just going against the Sanhedrin on a Drabanan. And so I think the Ramban would say that if the dispute was about Jewish history, about what exactly the legislation was, so then I probably should follow my own opinion rather than the opinion of the Sanhedrin. That last one I think is a little bit questionable, but the five are the backbone of this packet. Five different answers. When do I follow my own conviction, intellectual honesty? Only, they're saying Yimintu is small, so forget it. And when do we say no, that I should follow them for the sake of unity, for the sake of being humble, for the sake of mitzvah of Lo Sasur? And we had those five. That's the backbone of everything.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming.
Nice catch here, boys.
Stop this.
Should I leave this here?
What?
Should I leave this here?
No.